Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 105, recorded May 29th, 2013. Douglas Rushkoff. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get the greatest, most interesting, smartest people on the internet, and we get to talk to them, pick their brains, and you get to be a part of it. You're the third leg of the triangulation. Me, our guest, and you, if you're watching live in our chat room, we take the questions from the chat room, give you a chance to speak right back to our guest. And a great guest today, Douglas Rushkoff, has been around for a lot of years as a commentator on the cyber scene. In fact, his first book was all about the cyber world way back when it was early days in 1994. Siberia, he called it, Life in the Trenches of Cyberspace. His newest book just came out, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome to Triangulation.
It's great to see you again.
Good to have you. So I take it Present Shock is a play on Alvin Toffler's Future Shock.
Definitely. You know, it's funny to think that Future Shock was...
It's so old.
40 years ago. Yeah, I know. I was going to say Future Shock is 10 minutes ago, but it's actually 40 years ago. but there was this sense, for me anyway, how at the end of the 20th century, really the 70s, 80s, 90s, everybody was just leaning into the millennium. It was, you know, what's next? What's the next big thing? People were talking about the long boom and the dot-com explosion and this sense that the economy and the universe and everything was just going to keep expanding and growing. We got closer to the year 2000, and we thought the Y2K bug was going to come, and planes were going to fall out of the sky. And we finally, you know, we got to the year 2000, and it felt a whole lot less like we were leaning into the future and much more like we had arrived. Here we are. You know, what are my stocks actually worth? What, you know, what am I doing here? And in some sense, the future that Toffler was describing actually happened, but in the way that it happened, though, it turned us from a society that was just leaning forward and looking ahead to one that was looking around us, in some ways even just distracted by what was happening now, but very much, you know, focused on the moment rather than what was ahead. And that's sort of what I wanted to play with Present Shock.
It's a little bit it's of a dystopia, isn't it? I mean, it's not quite the utopia that science fiction authors predicted for the future. That even, I mean, Alvin Toffler talked about Consciousness 3, a new level of consciousness. It was a very utopian look. Do you feel like we made it to that utopia?
You know, I don't. And I feel like it's our fault. You know, I don't blame the technology. I never blame the technology. People think, oh, you used to love technology, now you don't. It's like, no, I'm just mad at the way we decided to implement the technology. You know, when I first encountered digital stuff, I thought, here was the great road to Slack. You know, now we could get off the industrial age clock. You know, we get out of the time as money. We've got to expand the sort of debt-based, you know, economic expansion machine and treadmill that we were all on. And we could, you know, work from home on our own schedule in our underwear. And instead of taking advantage of the asynchronous quality of these technologies, instead of treating email like email, we treated email like a telephone, as if every email coming in is a thing we have to answer in the present. And we strap the devices to ourselves, and we end up interrupting ourselves every time somebody tweets or updates or has anything for us, and we live in this state of perpetual emergency interruption, which is the kind of state of consciousness that used to be endured only by air traffic controllers, not by regular human beings.
And it was considered the most stressful job in the world.
Yeah, now just living is the
that's the most stressful job in the world is living.
And it's really just because I would argue, and you know, and it's really the theme of your shows over the years, is that if you become the programmer, if you have your digital devices conform to the way you live as a person, then they'll support you. But if you try to optimize yourself to the devices, you end up chasing your own tail. You end up in what I'm calling present shock.
Right. Yeah, we're all suffering a little bit. I wonder, though, if we, I mean, the human brain is so plastic. It's funny, we were talking about this on Sunday on Twit with Natalie Morris. She and her husband, Clayton, who are technology journalists and reporters, recently took a course in transcendental meditation and mindfulness. And she said, and it was a lot of it was about pulling back from these devices and being present. And yet I also wonder if the human brain, it's so plastic, maybe it's adapting to this. Maybe there's a positive to all these inputs and we'll get good at handling them. We'll retain our serenity, but we will just know more. We'll synthesize more. We'll think more. Isn't that a possibility?
It's a possibility, but I would argue it's a remote one. You know, neuroplasticity is real. You know, a kid who's raised playing with Barbies is going to have a different kind of brain than a kid who's raised playing exclusively with Legos or with video games or with an iPad. But, you know, the range of neural outcomes is kind of limited. You know, and so far anyway, we haven't really seen anybody who can be in more than one place at the same time. You know, that there is a... even if you expand your awareness, there's still a one-pointedness to it. There's a you are in one place at a time. It's kind of what the stream of consciousness is. And until you can actually break the stream, I don't think we're going to get that neuroplastic where you're going to have, okay, I'm thinking about this while I'm also thinking about this. It kind of doesn't work. You can get very good at switching back and forth between those two things, but in that switching it's sort of like listening to digital music. There's that constant, you know, choice. It's this series of little interrupted moments, and you never experience, you know, continuity. I'm not saying we can't do it. I just don't want to be doing it all the time. I want to have analog experiences, you know, as well as these digital ones, whether they're online or not, whether they're through devices or not. I want to still have continuous experiences, contemplative, longer form moments of consciousness.
Does that mean now we have to actively choose it? We have to become aware of this issue and say we're going to choose to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, yes, but you're also free to choose none of the above. You know, it's like, yes, we're going to choose to do it, but I don't want people to have to be in a constant state of making choices. So, you know, you look at something like call waiting. Yeah, you know, call waiting gives you the choice. It was really my first digital kind of moment, my first moment of what I've been calling digiphrenia. Like, what do I do? What do I do?
I got one call and another one's calling in. What do I do?
Exactly. What do I do? Do I stop? And that's before you could look at the caller ID and see who it was. It's like, oh, there's another call, and I want to see, is it somebody maybe I want to talk to more than I want to talk to you?
Right.
You know, right. Sort of what you're implicitly saying. You know, and now you can say, okay, well, I've got caller ID. I can just pull the phone away. They don't know that I'm doing it, and I'm going to look and see who it is, and I'm going to make the choice as to whether I take the new call or not. But the fact of the matter is I've had to make another choice. Another decision point has been entered into my flow, and we need to be able to opt out of even that. In other words, no, I'm not going to have my device vibrate on me. I'm not going to be constantly available to everybody who wants me to choose to be with them at that particular moment.
It does feel like when you put it that way, that each one of these attention grabbers takes a little piece of us, is nibbling away at a little piece of us in our consciousness until there's nothing left.
Well, right. And I'm not and I'm a techno enthusiast.
I know.
So, you know, so what I'm saying is, yeah, you can use this stuff in such a way where it's all taking different pieces of you. You know, the worst way to write a book, I'll tell you this from experience, is with Apple's new email open. Because Apple's new email, if you're getting new email, it pops in.
It notifies
the screen. You're getting notifications of emails coming in. And it's like, I'm not going to look. It's like, all right, I'm going to figure out how to disable that notification.
But we must want that, Douglas. Why else would they be doing this to us? Notifications are everywhere now. Things are buzzing and beeping and booping all the time. Don't we want this?
I don't think we do. I actually don't. I think what we ended up doing was taking the agenda of the industrial age, which is that time is money, you know, expansionist economic outlook. We were desperate for new territories. The stock exchanges were not growing. They really hadn't been growing since the 70s. We had a biotech boom, but that went away very quickly, for those who remember. We were in a rut economically. And the internet comes along, and instead of using it for you know, Dougie Rushkoff's slacker utopia, we ended up saying, oh my gosh, there's an entire attention economy out there. What we can do is the new commodity in this space, the new territory is going to be human attention.
Right.
So we're going to find out ways to get more and more, to suck more and more value out of everybody's awareness. So I don't feel it's me wanting to know when the email came in. Although if I have that obsessive compulsive relationship to the crackberry, like many of us develop, I might want it, but I would argue that's not the real me. It's the companies that want us doing that. It's, you know, Facebook that wants us checking for new status updates. It's Twitter wanting us to see new feed. Because the more we do, the more we consume, the more we produce. You know, we are the labor force, you know, for this information economy.
John Markoff, in his book, What the Dormouse Saw, talks about how all of this came out of the 60s counterculture. And you're very much a product, as am I, of the 60s counterculture. But that wasn't what this isn't what we were trying to accomplish. What is it?
No, it's not what we meant. It's not what we meant.
Where do we go? But, you know, somebody like Steve Jobs was a very interesting mix of hippie and businessman, and combine it in a way that seemed very unusual. Is the model of success?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, and it's not to get Marxist on you or anything, but, you know, I feel like what we did was we didn't acknowledge that there was an operating system running under all of this all the time, which is, you know, corporate capitalism. You know, we didn't look at the biases of that. When I look at these, you know, supposedly revolutionary young, you know, app makers, you know, whether it's, you know, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg or the Twitter people or the Snapchat kids, you know, any of them, it's like, you create this great disruptive device or disruptive tool, and you're happy to disrupt the book industry, right? You're happy to disrupt television. I'm happy to disrupt music. But what's the first thing they really want to do is run into the arms of daddy at Goldman Sachs and get my Series B,
right?
You know, get my. So what are they really doing is in some sense reifying the biggest, baddest, and oldest institutions, you know, that have been around, rather than actually challenging, you know, the underlying operating system, this 13th century economic operating system that not only does nobody seem to question, but nobody seems to understand is an operating system, that it's actually still there.
Is that particularly or peculiarly American? I mean, is it the same around the world?
No, I think it is peculiarly American. You know, I think that's part of what, I mean, Europe was just what they've just gone through, is if we can't beat them, we're going to join them. So we're going to make the euro and get all international. And, you know, and then you got all these sweet people in Italy going, wait a minute.
Why, I want to eat lunch.
It's just that we were sitting around. We were having a good time here. You know, you break this, you know, because you go to a place like, you know, you go to Italy, you know, walk around in the evening in Rome, and there's people that are just sitting outside talking.
Yeah.
It's like they're sitting around. No, get on your phone.
Wow.
At least send it as a message. This is non-commodified. You know, when you look at us, we don't sit around and eat pops on the front
street. But Douglas, we never have. I mean, we didn't have that tradition in the U.S.
You're ill. You know, there's a difference. No, people do, though. People do. And I would say, you know, maybe partly because I'm married and I have a kid now, I'm really cherishing my it's not my non-mediated time as much as my non-commodified time.
Right.
You know, time that's direct. I still, you know, will have a Skype with someone I love who's across the country, and that's still a kind of connection. But I'm not going to do those all night. I want to know my neighbors. Right. I want to understand what's going on in my real world.
You're not anti-technology. You're just saying let's get off the treadmill.
Right, and let's be conscious and let's use it to make more time for ourselves rather than to take time away, and really, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do in the book, is help people distinguish between present shock and presentism. I do believe digital technology brings us into a very different relationship to time. You know, the analog clock broke up the day into all of these little units. You know, we looked at this is morning, it's afternoon, this is evening. Digital time is very different. Digital time is, you know, remember that first digital clock that you had, that first clock radio with the little flip down, those little numbers. It'd be like, it's 301, pop, It's 302.
Yep.
Bah, it's 303. So it's this sense of, I mean, it's a very good metaphor for a digital time, which kind of sits there in the moment. In some sense, it's very zen. It's like you're just here. You know, you're not going to anything or coming from anything. You're not bound by your legacy. You're not moving towards a particular history. You don't have to have your eye on the prize and reach toward this thing. That's why, you know, political campaigns don't work. Most marketing campaigns don't work. Brand mythologies have fallen away. Ideologies don't quite seem real. And that's all to the credit, in some sense, of coming out of that analog version of time, that very industrial age, goal-oriented expansionist sensibility. But, you know, rather than accepting this new sort of present is zen, we do chase after the moment of our devices. We're chasing that sort of rear view mirror.
And you can never catch up. Inbox zero is a fantasy.
It is a fantasy. And, you know, and the folks I talk to about it, like Mark Hurst, who I love, I respect him tremendously. He wrote a book on it. He's got a company called Creative Good that helps manage people's time and email. And he goes, oh, you've got to do inbox zero. You've got to get it down to zero or you won't get that clean feeling. It's like, oh, it sounded like, you know, like some hygiene, you know, clean feeling. It's like, no, we've got to live. You're never going to get that clean feeling again. And it's okay. You know, it's okay that there's email sitting in that box. Just because they sent the email doesn't mean you have to answer it, right? They've relegated to the atemporal universe of email. You don't have to assume it back, you know, into your timeline, you know, until you're good and ready.
You know, I think about companies like Zynga, which got very good at manipulating this social compulsion where if you're playing Farmville, you're no longer allowed not to play the game because your friends will say, hey, you got to come to my farm. You got to clean it up. And all of a sudden, there's this social compulsion to participate in this treadmill activity. And then you're really in trouble. And they play on it.
Of course. I mean, when you look at where's the money going now, you know, where are we spending it? Anybody who's not getting paid, you know, millions to go work for Goldman to make ultra-fast trading algorithms, which are themselves present shock, right? These are algorithms that are literally trading in your future, right? When you make a trade, they execute before your thing goes through. So that's another thing. But the best minds of my generation are being hired to figure out how to make these interfaces more addictive, more compulsive. You know, and that's just because the companies will make more money doing that. But it's not that's not a particularly healthy relationship to your email or to your Farmville or to any of these things. It's not a pleasurable feeling.
It isn't.
Sated.
Yeah. You know? And I don't care if you get to inbox zero tomorrow. It's just as filthy as it was when you started.
So, well, and those if you live that life where you get to inbox zero, you're going to have way more email than people like me who let it sit.
That's right.
You let the email sit.
That's right.
For the course of the day, you see the problem get solved by the other people in the CC chain before it's like, God.
I realized it because I had no choice. I finally just said, I know I'm not going to, I don't do email. And people stopped emailing me. It's amazing.
I know. Well, yeah.
They get mad at me. They don't like me because they can't reach me. But you got to protect yourself.
You've got to draw your limits. And that's okay. You know, and that's the whole thing about, you know, who's the Ubermensch of the 21st century? Is it the person that has, I've got my Twitter, my Snapchat, my Pinterest, my this, my that, my that, blah, 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 you know, and I can share everything at once and broadcast. It's like, or is it the person who said, you know, this is where I hang out. This is what I do. I don't, you know, I do Twitter. I don't do Facebook. I do email. I don't do Snapchat. It's like, that's just
right.
And that's just fine.
Or you could do, I mean, I sign up for everything, but I don't. But the key is, I guess, not to feel compelled to do it. To be at choice.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you really got to realize it's not, I mean, the technology sometimes feel like they're compelling you to do it, but it's not the email that's doing it. It's the person who sent you the email that's doing it. These are social problems, not technology problems.
Right. You did a really great frontline on the merchants, called The Merchants of Cool, about how teenagers are being marketed to. When you're born into this system, the system immediately grabs a hold of you and starts to mold you in this way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's all these different media properties. It's funny. We're just doing an update to that document. That documentary was made in the era of Fred Durst. was not.
It hasn't. The point hasn't changed much, though, right? I mean,
no, it hasn't. It's just the brands have changed.
Right.
You know, it's
the brands
really
have changed
so much.
Yeah,
but no, sort of doing an update of that and looking at, you know, what's the new, what's the real difference now? And it's interesting. When I was a kid, you know, we'd go to the Spencer Gifts in the mall. And like, it's an old person's store. We'd go to Spencer Gifts and you'd buy like posters of rock bands or models where you'd put them up on your bedroom wall. And, you know, they would reflect back to you who you were. Maybe a friend would come into your room and they'd say, oh, that Farrah poster's not cool anymore. You should take that down, you know, whatever. Now that process happens in public, right? Kids, you know, you find what your bedroom wall is the Facebook wall and you're broadcasting it. You know, it's not coming to you. It's a performative act that's done in public for the world. You know, and that's, I mean, it's such a different relationship to this iconography. The impact is very different.
But nobody's more vulnerable to social coercion than a teenager.
Yeah, well, they're living it. I mean,
that's why I worry, because I feel like with the tools of social coercion, they're so finely honed now, and teenagers just grow up right into it. They're already vulnerable. Peer relationships are all that matter to them. Mm. And what do they do? I mean, what's the message you give them?
The message I always give them is program or be programmed. You know, learn. If you're not going to learn how to program, at least learn how to look at these faces critically. How does this face make me feel? What is this thing? This is not a pre-existing condition of the universe. And I feel like a lot of kids are getting that message one way or another. I mean, the way they're all leaving Facebook, and people are saying, oh, they're leaving because it's where their parents are and they want to be able to do stuff without their parents there. Yes and no. If you actually talk to them, which I've been doing now because of the new documentary, they'll say, well, you know, it feels weighty. You know, it feels heavy. It feels more complicated. You know, the fact is, it is weighty. There's this giant big data engine back there, you know, that's sucking all your data and feeding you the marketing from your future into your present. Meanwhile, you've got your friends from first grade who are trying to friend you into your present. So that's pure present shock, right? This sense of weight of almost claustrophobic pressure from the future and the past, where you go on Snapchat, not only does it disappear, there's no, it's just, it's a blip. The whole thing only lasts 4 seconds and it's gone. You know, even Twitter has that, a much lighter feeling. It's much more of an app-like light feel. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to dip into it like a stream and then leave. It's not creating the archive. It's not, you know, some my life bits, you know, mirror of my bigger self.
So how do we kind of escape? You say program or be programmed. How do we escape from this corporate domination, this environment where we are being really, we're really, you know, you're either the cow that's eating the grass, or you're trying to sell the cow the grass. I mean, how do you become a creator instead of a consumer, I guess?
Well, I mean, we're starting to see the hint of that.
The tools are there.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, and we're seeing the beginnings between Square and Etsy and alternative currencies. You know, people are realizing that, oh, if I've got one of these, I mean, I don't mean an iPhone. I mean, any, you know, if I've got an authentication engine in here, you know, I can do a secure transaction. I can do authenticate better than the Federal Reserve can at this point. So I don't need them in order to have a secure transaction. I don't even need to be using their money.
So you're a Bitcoin fan.
Not really. I'm a fan of the idea of Bitcoin. What I don't like about Bitcoin is it's still a scarcity-based central currency, just being generated and made scarce through other means. So it's still the same model of currency. It's biased towards saving and speculation. I'm much more interested in a kind of real-time, steady-state currencies that would be biased towards transaction. You know, how do we increase the frequency and the velocity of circulation of a currency? And that's really that's by looking at currency less as something you keep than something that you try to spend. That's something that you try to keep in motion. And that's, you know, going to be based on how it's programmed. But, you know, what I argue for in present shock is a presentist society where, you know, you're doing what you do. You're trading, you're making, you're creating value directly with other people. So on the one hand, it means, you know, accepting this new localism. You know, this hunger for localism is not just a fad. It's not a style. It's actually an innate sense that it is more efficient to begin to source things from other people rather than these super long, complex, and bizarre supply chains. Yeah, you're going to buy your iPhone maybe from a big corporation, but your Swiss chard you can get from the field, you know, next to you, and you'll be a lot healthier than getting it from a truck from 4,000 miles away. Or your local, your goods, your services. A lot of things can be fulfilled locally, or if not locally, at least directly. You know, we can engage. Here we are, you and me. We're talking. I'm hawking my book. You're doing your show. You know, where's the network? Where's Fox? You know, where's the thing? You're just doing it, right? Screw it. I'm just going to do it. And you end up what? Advertising products that you actually happen to like.
Yeah.
Oh my God, imagine that. You know? And they happen to like you and support your show. It's like, wait a minute. This is not supposed to be a virtuous circle here. I thought this was supposed to be bad. No, commerce can actually be good and real and present and connected. And I think that's where we push it towards.
I don't know if I consciously did that, but I think that was the motivation, was to get out of big media and to carve a niche where we could relate directly to our audiences. We could make a living by selling products that we liked, but somehow keep it at a more human scale. About small business versus big business, local versus global?
I think it's a different scale of business. I mean, all of us who were certainly me, you know, raised in the 60s and 70s, you want to get big. You want to get on TV. You want to be a brand, you know. And it's kind of like the biggest brands of the late 20th century were like Paris Hilton, you know.
Kim Kardashian. It's like
there's nothing exactly.
There's nothing there.
They specifically, the reason why they're the best brands is because they have no competency.
Right.
They can't actually do anything.
It's all brand.
Right. Just brand. Nothing but brand.
Pure brand. Platonic brand.
Pure. It just shows that they're the best at branding. You have to give that a certain thing up, right? When you want to be an activist today, you have to give up the idea that, oh, I'm going to create the website that aggregates all the websites of all the people who are all doing this kind of thing. It's like, no, actually, it gets small again. It's sustainable. It's real. It's just not growth. You don't get the same ta-da, you know, that same, you don't win big. You just win. You know, you get to keep playing the game. It's what, you know, I write a lot in Present Shock about this, that in a presentist world, you no longer play games in order to win the game, because winning the game ends the play. You know, instead, in a presentist world, it's much more like a fantasy role-playing game, where you're playing in order to keep the game going. You know, that's the object of the game, is to keep playing.
Right. It feels a little moralist. We're talking ethics. Is that right?
I would even say moralist. You know, I'm not even going to shy away from that. It's moralist in that morals come from humans. You know, and I think it's time for the human beings to take charge of the asylum here. You know, there's a lot of my peers are arguing that technology is going to soon, you know, outpace human beings, that the entirety of history is information trying to evolve towards more complex states. And once computers are better at doing it than human beings are, you know, we might as well just recede to the background and let technology take over, you know, and this sort of singularity like zombie apocalypse in the future. And it's human loathing, you know, and I just don't agree. I think human beings are special. I'm on team human.
Right.
And if that's egotistical, fine. I'm a human, right? So I'm gonna
vote for my team. But you know what I love about what you're saying, Doug, is you're not abandoning technology at all.
No.
You know, and I think when you first started writing in the early 90s, it was an embrace of technology, and this is exciting. What the world is changing. And then I get the feeling that you got disillusioned a little bit at some point along the way.
Well, I got disillusioned really by how quickly business was able to really make technology about its agenda.
Right.
And how rapidly people forgot about the kinds of empowerment that technology could offer. That it wasn't about consumer empowerment, but about right. actually making stuff.
So it went from the well and the internet, where it was just a place people communicated, to a better way to sell you more crap.
Right, to an electronic strip mall, really.
Right.
With a turbocharged one, and one that now made people feel we're actually responsible for keeping this economy growing. You know, that's your responsibility as a citizen. Keep shopping. Keep making.
Keep shopping.
You know, for what?
But you're not a Luddite. You're not trying to throw a monkey wrench into this gear. What do you?
No.
What do we? What do you want? What do we? What do we need to do?
A few things. I mean, one, I would. Gosh, a lot of things. One, I would. If I were a human being, I would.
Speaking for Team Human.
Yeah. Realize that the real world is the home turf of Team Human.
Right.
Right. The virtual world really isn't our home turf. That's home turf to corporations, really, and abstract things more than it is to human bodies. So you need to become coherent and oriented, right? And that's as simple as looking out the window, knowing when it's night and day. I have a whole section in the book talking about different phases of the moon. There's new research that's showing that your neurochemistry changes each week of the lunar cycle. So in the first week, you have more acetylcholine. The second week, you have more serotonin. Third week, you have more dopamine. The fourth week, you have more norepinephrine. If you know that, then you know that, oh, it's acetylcholine week, good for meeting people. Serotonin week, good for getting work
that
done.
Sounds dopamine, like astrology, Douglas.
Sounds like astrology, but it's neurochemistry.
Right.
Right. I mean, come on, talk to any woman about the moon. We've known for a long time. There's these cycles that your body has biological clocks. It's no more folklore than jet lag, which everyone said was folklore until Major League Baseball managers realized that pitchers did worse traveling west to east than they did traveling east to west.
Right.
So first I would do that. Try to orient yourself. Try to create some basic coherence with your body in space, on the planet, with other people. You know. And second, I would say learn to think critically about digital devices. You know, how does this thing make me feel? What is the agenda? Who is the customer? I mean, when you see kids on Facebook and you ask them, who's the customer of Facebook? And they go, oh, well, I am. It's like, oh, are you paying Facebook? Well, no. Who is paying Facebook? Oh, you know, once you just help, you know, people orient that way to these environments, it's really a start. And then you think, well, what can you do with this? And then you see the maker movement, the craft movement. You see Etsy. You see peer-to-peer. You see all of this, all of these ways that people are using these technologies to really restore their own agency rather than just to surrender to some other corporation's idea of who or what they should be.
Do you sometimes feel like you're talking to addicts and trying to convince us, because I feel like an addict, to give up our drug?
Yeah, you know, I used to feel like I was talking to people having a bad trip. Right, I'd go on CNN and they're like, "Oh my God, what is email? What is it going to do? What is the web going to happen? Is it going to get me into the wild?"
This is your universe. You belong here.
Exactly. It's all okay. Go with it. Touch the email. How does it feel? But yeah, and you know, and what I wrote this piece. I quit Facebook. Right.
Are you're still off it?
Yeah, stupidly before the book came out. I should have done it right after the.
Yeah,
book.
You know what? You're missing out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. But all the emails I got, you know, were less from people angry at me for doing it and more from people saying, oh, my God, how are you going to do this? Yeah. How are you going to live? You know, and it was just like, wow, you know, I'm a lot. I have more time. I'll tell you that much. You know, it was like a weight lifted for me. That just was an interface. It was just a world I didn't like being a part of. I mean, I could see being part of some kind of phone directory, I guess, but I just didn't want my face on ads. I don't know where it's going. And what am I promoting and who am I being linked to with? It was too much for me to start thinking about and worrying about. So, you know, it can be done. So yeah, we are.
I get pleasure. I can feel my, whatever it is, pleasure receptors going when I get a new gadget and I get a new toy, I get a software update. It feeds something inside
the
me.
Endorphins.
Endorphins.
Oh, yeah. They do. These are endorphins. It's just, I mean, you will get a faster hit of endorphins, you know, from getting an update or getting that new app or snorting a line of Coke than you will seeing a beautiful sunset.
Yep.
Right? But over time, you know, you will have a more coherent and a happier life if you're not looking for, you know, those quick, immediate, fast, fake hits, you know, and instead trying to, you know, find a more emergent rhythm from you rather than the, you know, chasing the rhythm of these devices.
Somehow I feel like that, well, it was easy for you, Doug, because you just, you have that bent. You never were really crazy about this stuff. I mean, how did you do it for yourself? Was it at all difficult?
No, you know, it was, life was getting difficult, you know?
You could see the consequences of this treadmill?
I was trying to write this book, you know, and I was being distracted so constantly by so many things I was supposed to keep up with. Oh, you know, your website is this and that page is down and this thing, you got to write this business.
Oh, I know that feeling.
I started to keep a marginalia on the edge of the book. You know, I was going to write down everything I'm not doing in order to write the book. So I thought it would be kind of cute to have it on the sidelines of the book. As you read, you could see, oh, he didn't answer this email. He didn't do this talk. He missed out on this money. But the things I wasn't doing became so much bigger than the book. It would have been like 30 books of stuff I didn't do in order to write this one book of stuff. And that was what made me realize I got to just be okay with it. In some sense, because I had so much more technology and more required, you know, things to do than most people, I kind of hit that wall faster. But I think most of us will hit that wall and we're going to be forced to make choices, and that's really okay.
Yeah. Or I guess the choice you could make is to embrace it and to dive in, and what is the end result there? Some sort of crazed schizophrenia or something.
The end result of that is the school play I go to where the parents are holding up the thing, and you know, or I went to a Nick Cave show and people are sitting there shooting the thing.
You cannot go to a concert because everybody's looking at the concert through their phone. Or worse, their iPad.
I know.
And all you see is a bunch of screens. It's a very strange experience.
It is.
I remember I was a little disturbed a few years ago. I went to Paris and I was sitting outside of Notre Dame and I was a little disturbed to notice that everybody in Paris was this was before cell phones were really big in the U.S. and we're looking at their cell phones the whole time. And I thought, this something's wrong here. And of course, now this is the universal experience. But do you think we will realize that and overcome it, or?
I hope we will. I mean, that's why I'm writing about a present shock to say, you know, we're in this state of shock, and it's okay to recognize that this is overtaxing you, that you're in, you know, that you're having these syndromes, whether it's those narrative collapse or digiphrenia, fractal noia, these kind of different ways of describing it, you know, that you know, we're all suffering from these things, and it's okay to admit that and to find more appropriate ways of moving into this new presentist world. I mean, it took us a couple of hundred years to adapt to the industrial age, right? Machinery and money and clocks and all that was very new. And digital technology is also new. We just have to implement it mindfully and slowly and carefully, and it becomes much I'm not personally threatened by it. You know, I do feel a little weird walking around and seeing the people who are, it hasn't been that hard for me.
What about kids? Do you think that they're getting this and they're choosing to slow down a little bit, or are they not, are they just sucked right into it?
Until a couple of years ago, I would have said kids are sucked up right into it, right? They accept Facebook and all these things as given circumstances.
They seem to be turning away from Facebook of late.
But they are, right. Yeah. They're moving towards lighter things. They are attracted more to you know, Tumblr and Pinterest and Snapchat and things like that, because I do think that they sense the tentacles of these larger interfaces, and they're uncomfortable with that.
Is that the problem? Is it that big business is trying to sell us? Is that really the fundamental problem?
It's one of them. It's that we've taken, you know, it's hard to blame it on corporations, although you can. It's that
they make a good fall guy anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we've taken the agenda of the industrial age, which is time is money.
Right.
You know, and we've got to expand. We've taken that agenda and we try to transpose it into the digital era, whereas the digital era can actually bring us something different. You know, the digital era has a different relationship to time and ultimately a different relationship to money and value creation. And if we try to amplify the industrial age through the digital, we're going to get, you know, Facebook mania, right? We are going to get that thing. We are going to go crazy. But if instead we realize what works about digital technology, you know, I do think we get maybe not utopia, but I think we end up moving rather than towards a growth society or continuing this growth, goal-based, future-based world, we end up with a presentist world, one that's looking towards sustainability, you know, rather than towards the finish line.
Are you bullish? Are you an optimist?
I'm hopeful. I've got a daughter. Mm-hmm.
How old's your daughter?
She's 8 years old.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So it's hard. It's hard to be too pessimistic.
Right.
You know, but I'm concerned.
Yeah. And what messages will you give her as she grows older?
You know,
when she becomes a screenager, as you call it.
I'll try to stress her agency, you know, above all else.
Yeah.
You know, what do you really want here and how does this make you feel? Are you in charge of this experience? Are you surrendering your authority to somebody else? And if you are, that's okay. Just do it consciously and mindfully rather than, you know, as a matter of course.
Well, I hope we can all do this.
I do too. We'll see.
We live in, you know, I also feel like it's more, you're right. We're air traffic controllers now, each and every one of us. And to some degree, we've adapted.
To some degree, we're just taking more drugs, you know? You know, I think the most hopeful sign is when the Prozac doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, if the drugs are not good enough to maintain this lifestyle, then we'll change it.
That's a good point. There's a lot of Prozac out there. Douglas Rushkoff's new book is called Present Shock, A Plea for Presentism. And here it is, present in your life right now. It's on Amazon and everywhere bookstores are. And great to talk to you, Douglas. I really appreciate you taking some time.
Great to talk to you. Gosh, that's for what you do.
Oh, you know, this is part of the fun of it, is getting to hear ideas and to think and to probe into this. And, you know, you're speaking right now to people who are fully immersed in technology. They love technology. That's what this channel is all about. But I think it's always been don't be programmed has always been the philosophy. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, and if you truly love it, you know, if you truly love it, then you're going to be using it right.
Yeah.
You know, people who are sitting there with their BlackBerries and stuff, they're not loving it.
Yeah.
You know, so in some sense, it's push through, you know, rather than try to avoid.
Yeah. Boy, I struggle with that. I love the toys. But I realize we also have a higher mission. We can't just say, hey, buy that, now buy that, now buy that, now buy that, and buy that, right. and you will be happy, because you won't. You won't.
Nope.
Thank you, Douglas.
All right.
Doug Rushkoff, take care. We do Triangulation every Wednesday about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2200 UTC, 2300 UTC on the Twit Network. If you can watch live on Wednesdays, do. But if not, don't worry. Don't worry. We'll do it on demand for you. Audio and video always available after the fact. twit.tv/TRI. There are now 105 episodes up there, and all of them fascinating, great, interesting people. So thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time on Triangulation.